What we've been talking about tonight is the Longevity Project, surprising discoveries for health and long life from the landmark 8-decade study. We'll be back with more with Dr. Howard Friedman on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Howard Friedman with us. Howard, also tell us about the Longevity Project. The book came out in March, I believe, not too long ago. So yes. How's it doing?
Well, it's getting a lot of attention. We've been on a number of TV shows, and it's coming out in all kinds of international editions in German and Russian and Korean and Chinese and on and on and on. So there's a lot of attention because there's never been a study like this. It's scientific, but the book was written for the average layperson to be able to understand it. And it does have little assessments and examples in the book so people can kind of figure out how they're doing. And, you know, it's not 100%, but it's it gives you some good idea of whether you're heading on a more healthy trajectory and what changes you can make in your own life. But really, it's a presentation of 25 years of scientific research based on 8 decades of data collection.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now, we've heard the old saying, stress kills. Is that true?
Well, that was really one of the most interesting things that we found, that stress, in the sense that people usually think about it, is not necessarily a problem. So you always hear, take it easy, don't work so hard, but we didn't find that at all. We found that the people who work the hardest, they tended to live the longest. It was just really striking. So the ones who had success in their careers and even moved up more and more in their careers, mm-hmm. they did better and better.
Deadlines, working on deadlines, things like pressure helped them.
Well, pressure, if you could do it. So if you have a lot of deadlines, a lot of pressure, and you don't have the resources, and you have nasty coworkers, then that's not good. But if you kept increasing responsibility, like you said, you moved up. You know, your father was asking you, when are you going to be in the news bureau, and you know, when are you going to have your national radio show. That kind of move up is very healthy. You know, you have more and more responsibility, but you have more and more resources, and you thrive. One of the people we studied was one of the participants who has been publicly identified is Edward Dmytryk. He was the highly successful director of the Caine Mutiny, starring Humphrey Bogart back in 1954. And
right.
He had anything but an unstressful life. He was the son of Ukrainian immigrants. And his family had moved to San Francisco and then Los Angeles, so just in time for him to be noticed by his teacher. And he was recommended to Dr. Terman, and he was included in this study. And his mother died, and his father was not very nice to him, and he had to go to work as a teenager as a low-paid messenger at Paramount Pictures. And he worked his way up in the film industry. He still had more and more stress. In 1947, his movie career just ground to a halt because he was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was investigating communists and communist sympathizers in Hollywood. And he refused to testify, and he became one of the Hollywood Ten. Those were the directors and producers who were cited for contempt of Congress and then blacklisted. And he was sent to a federal prison camp. His wife divorced him. Okay, stress, right? So a few years later, he said, okay, I want to work again, and he decided to change his stance, and he said, you know, I did have some communist sympathies in the 1930s, but, you know, I'm going to testify anyway. I don't really support that anymore. And so then he was scorned by some in Hollywood on both sides who thought he shouldn't have been affiliated and then who thought that he shouldn't have testified. So he was both a sellout and an informer and a former communist, and so you know, he had a lot of interpersonal stress, yet he went on to have a really spectacular career. In addition to the Caine Mutiny, he directed Spencer Tracy and Clark Gable and Elizabeth Taylor and Marlon Brando. So you might think, well, all that stress, well, is that bad for him? How long did he live? He lived almost the full 20th century. He died he died at age 90. So we said, how can that be? And that's really where we started looking into the stress. And it turns out that relax, avoid stress, don't work so hard, those are really common advice, but they turn out to be really poor advice, even rotten advice. As I said, if the people like Dmytryk who, you know, succeeded in their careers, moved up, and, you know, the stress didn't hurt them. They were able to overcome it, and that made them healthier. So if you're facing a situation where, you know, you're challenged, you should be able to think about it in a healthy way and realize that it can make you actually stronger in the long run. So we kept finding that again and again. The people who overcame their challenges, they became more resilient and were able to face future challenges in their lives.
I wonder, for example, Howard, how many people die of a heart attack stuck in like L.A. traffic or something like that?
Well, that kind of frustration when you can't do anything about it, that is unhealthy. And anything that, you know, gets your heart really beating fast, too fast, whether it's shoveling snow or you know, just, you know, making yourself more and more crazy in a trapped situation, that's certainly unhealthy. But working hard, you know, if you're heading towards, you know, some great performance you're going to do in LA, or you're heading towards, you know, some other job that you love, then it's probably not a problem.
Let's talk about exercise for a moment and how this fits into the equation as well. Generally, if you exercise, you're going to live longer. I have heard mixed things about that. I've heard stories of guys dying on the treadmill. What do you say?
Yeah, there's a lot of stories of that. And so we looked into that in some detail. And it was really interesting what we found. There's many active people who don't like to just exercise for the sake of exercise. And my favorite quote was from the astronaut Neil Armstrong. He said, "I believe the good Lord gave us a finite number of heartbeats, and I'll be damned if I'm going to use mine running up and down a street." So Armstrong, you know, he didn't mind the astronaut training. Was really rigorous, right? But there was no way anybody was going to make him, you know, go on endless jogs. And that's kind of what we found, that people who were naturally active in their activities from day to day across their life, they tended to stay healthy. The people who said, "Well, I'm going to get out there and do a lot of exercise," well, you know, they usually didn't. So if you're physically very active and you love going to the gym and you love, you know, jogging or whatever, that's fine if you can do it. But most of us, to make the resolution, a few months later, the gym's empty, the shoes are put away. In the days of these tournament participants, there weren't a lot of gyms, and they weren't Nike company didn't exist, and there was no jogging shoes. And so, how did they stay healthy? Well, they engaged in natural kinds of activities. And we looked at the children who were really active, like in college sports. And most of them, by the time they were middle age, they weren't so active anymore. And so, you know what? They didn't live very long. But the ones who had maintained some level of activity, maybe they always liked to go for walks, or maybe they liked woodworking, or maybe they liked even cooking, anything that got them up and out of their chair, that made a big difference. So when we looked at these trajectories from childhood through young adulthood, and my doctoral student, Peggy Kern, did a lot of this great work, and we found really clearly if you could stay active into middle age, that was a really good sign. It kept you healthy, and it promoted long life. So I think we give too many oversimplified health recommendations. Get out there and do all this vigorous exercise. Most people aren't going to do that. You know, if you think back even 50 years, when John Kennedy became president, he almost immediately began emphasizing the importance of physical health.
Yes.
And he said, you know, we want to do 50-mile hikes. And that same year, one of the tournament participants, Ansel Keys, was on the cover of Time magazine. And he told Americans, you know, "Americans, you eat too much." So now we're exactly 50 years later, right? So we had President Kennedy saying, "Get out there and run, do these hikes and do this, get in shape." And we had Ansel Keys saying, "You eat too much." Well, that didn't have any good effect, right? So now people are more out of shape and more overweight than ever. So that's one of the important lessons of the Longevity Project. Don't just give people lists of advice. That doesn't work for most people. It's good to have the knowledge, but then you need to develop the patterns that you can maintain over many years that really make a huge difference in how healthy you stay.
The kids who came from two different kinds of families, broken homes, happy homes, what happened?
Well, that was really surprising and somewhat disappointing, and a lot of people have been picking up on this now that it's becoming getting a lot of attention. We found that the strongest social predictor in childhood of early mortality. That means who is most likely to die at a young age in terms of social aspects of their lives was the children whose parents divorced when they were children. So it was a huge negative impact, and it wasn't anything that was just a function of the children. It was something about the conflict that they lived in. It led them to become poorer in their health habits. It led them to have poorer social relationships of their own, and then that really increased their risk for dying before their time. But there was good news there. There were some of the people whose parents divorced, some of the children, they were able to overcome it by the time they reached adulthood. They had established good relationships of their own, and they had accomplished things in their life. And if you had a sense of satisfaction and accomplishment, even though you had come from a rough childhood, and you were able to maintain good relationships, such as a good marriage yourself, then your risk dissipated. So there's bad news and there's good news. You know, the bad news, parental divorce, big risk factor, very bad for the children unless they unless it was a really negative environment to begin with, and then a lot of times it was better to get out of that. But still, it was overall, it was a negative. But many children were able to overcome it. But the ones who didn't, they engaged in unhealthy behavior, an unhealthy pattern after unhealthy pattern across the decades. And it took more than 5 years off their lives on average.
We're going to get some recommendations a little bit later on from you, Howard, just so we can kind of fine-tune the way we live and our lifestyle. What do you mean by catastrophic thinking? What's that?
Well, that is thinking that the world's going to come to an end when something small happens. So if an acorn drops on your head you say, the sky is falling, then we call you a catastrophizer. So if you explain things, bad events, as doom is everywhere, rather than saying, well, it's an isolated event and I'll be able to overcome it, that's called catastrophizing. So we look back when the determined participants were younger and as part of the longevity project, and we looked at how they explained things that had happened to them. And so we could tell who were the catastrophizers and who were the ones who weren't. And then we used that to predict what happened to them, what they died from, and how long they lived. And the results were pretty clear. The catastrophizers tended to die at a younger age, especially the men. And this held true even if we excluded the ones who died immediately following these kinds of assessments. It wasn't just that they were already ill and that's why they thought everything was bad in their lives. So if you saw misfortunes as pervasive in their effects, that you have character flaws and you're worthless and you can never overcome it, everything's bad, that leads step by step to a lot of problems, sometimes to heart disease. But also we found that catastrophizers were really much more likely to die from accidents or violence. So it was especially dangerous thinking that one thing goes wrong, you think lots and lots of things, bad things are going to follow. That puts you on a path for a violent early death. So we did look at suicide, and we looked at homicide, and we looked at accidents. And the ones most at risk for that were the catastrophizers. Here, too, there's good news, because people can change how they think about things. And so in the book, we do talk a little bit about some things you can do to try to get off that pattern of thinking.
Tell me about the age-old adage that women outlive men. Is this true?
Well, it is true. In fact, there's an old joke from Alan King that the six words in every man's obituary is he's survived by his wife. And we found that to be true as well, that the women significantly outlive the men. That's true in most societies around the world. But what was really interesting about the Longevity Project is we found a really twist to why that's true. People think, well, if women live longer, it must be something in their biology. Maybe it's their estrogen. But there's not really good proof of that. Nobody really knows why women live so much longer than men. But we got a good hint that people hadn't really thought about before in the Longevity Project. We looked at how masculine and feminine both the men and the women were. So this is a measure or a concept that you can apply to men, and some men are more manly, and some men are more interested in the arts, and they have more feminine traits, and some women are more masculine, and some women are more feminine. So we looked at that by seeing how what you were interested in terms of your careers. So the participants who said they were interested in more masculine type careers compared to others in this group, so it wasn't any absolute standards, those we called more masculine. And the ones who were interested in more feminine type careers, we called them a little bit more feminine. And then we looked, well, who lived longer? And it turned out that the feminine men and the feminine women outlive the more masculine men and the more masculine women.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
why?
Go ahead.
Why?
Well, you know, part of it is it's the feminine aspect of being female that makes women live longer. And probably that's because these people can establish better social relationships. So men who can disclose things to other people generally going to wind up getting more help for their problems and be healthier emotionally as well. Women who don't, you know, too masculine and can't establish good relationships with other women, they're going to be at risk, you know, for the same reason we've been talking about. So it's not saying everybody has to be feminine or nobody should be more masculine, but it has nothing to do with being gay or straight. It has to do with being able to relate to other people, disclose things about yourself, you know, open up really to other kinds of things in your life, and it made a difference, we found.
So, I mean, I find all of this just simply fascinating as you put all these different facets in there. So if genetically, is there a difference there that helps a woman over a guy?
Well, we couldn't look at that directly in our study, and there's been a lot of research, though, trying to look at that. And, you know, nobody's really figured it out yet. There's a lot of hypotheses, a lot of studies out there. But the bottom line is we just really don't know for sure. We know some things. You know, men tend to smoke more. Men tend to engage in real dangerous behaviors so that, you know, they put their lives at risk. But in terms of the real secret that explains everything, nobody really knows yet why women so significantly outlive men.
No, not at all. Okay, what advice would you give us, one single thing, in order to start changing our lives?
Well, this is kind of funny because if we have to give one piece of advice, we say throw away your lists. So, you know, we live in this kind of self-help society, which full of lists and resolutions, lose weight, sleep enough, you know, hit the gym, cut out the fast food, quit smoking, drink less, you know the list. So why isn't everybody healthy? So one thing that really came out of the Longevity Project was making endless lists of resolutions are a bad idea. So if you're going to read the book to get, you know, a list of 500 things you should do and you're going to stay healthy, you know, this is not the book. Our book tells you the patterns that produce the desired effect. So, you know, people try to, they lose weight and then they gain it right back. And they hit the gym and they tire out and they go back to the TV, you know. So, and even some people they can't sleep because they're worrying about how much they should sleep. So in the Longevity Project, the healthiest individuals, they didn't have lists and lists of health advice. Rather, they lived meaningful and committed lives. You know, they worked hard. They achieved much for their families. They nurtured close relationships. They were persistent. They were responsible. They were successful in their careers. And really, they were dedicated to things and people beyond themselves.
Howard, when we come back, I'm going to ask you about people who give off energy as opposed to those who suck it in and see if that has anything to do with longevity. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Howard Friedman as we talk about his longevity project. When we come back, much more to talk with him about on Coast to Coast AM. Howard, could you tell by the study whether kids who became adults, those who had that effervescence, that great personality, they were bubbly people, giving off energy, people could feel it, people wanted to be around them, as opposed to what I call the psychic vampire, the person where they just suck your energy, whether they're good people or not, people just don't want anything to do with them, they have to get away from them. Could you ascertain whether the happy person lived longer than the vampire?
Well, there's really two parts to that. We'll start with the kind of the vampire side of it first. One of the people we studied who was publicly identified was named Douglas Kelly, And he was a very interesting man. He grew up in San Francisco and into the study, and he went to college in Berkeley, and he became a pretty well-known forensic psychiatrist. And so he loved jokes and magic, so he seemed to have, you know, a lot of positive energy. But in fact, in 1941, he was in Time magazine as a psychiatrist who taught parlor tricks to his patients to help them get better. But in 1942, he was only 29. He was called to the U.S. Army, and he was sent to Europe. And very unusual assignment he had. After the war ended, he was assigned to the International Military Tribunal in Nuremberg in Germany, yes, where the Nazi war crimes trials were being prepared. And Dr. Kelly's job was to study the highest-ranking captured Nazis, including von Ribbentrop and Hermann Göring, really one of the most infamous and powerful evil Nazis. And so he gave them psychological tests and studied them, and we really spent a lot of time with them. He wrote a book after the war about his experiences in Nuremberg. But really, oddly, he collected Nazi memorabilia. And, Göring had been sentenced to be hanged, but he secretly swallowed these hidden potassium cyanide capsules he had, yeah, the night before he was to be executed.
Did himself in.
Well, he did himself in to cheat the hangman. But about 10 years later, something really shocking happened. On New Year's Day, Douglas Kelly, he was home with his wife and his children. He was just 45, and he had secretly brought back some of the cyanide capsules, and he swallowed the capsules and killed himself.
Oh.
In front of his family, and it really, you know, isn't that an amazing story? And nobody really knows
them
for sure, you know, because he just died. And I think it's what you just said. I mean, he was around these Nazis, and they shattered his view of the world. You know, you could say, as you put it, they sucked up his psychic energy. They were such evil, bad, you know, rotten people, and he could never get over having spent so much time in close contact interviewing them and getting to know them really well. Or you could also say, you know, as a psychologist might say, your sense of order and meaning in the world has been shattered, and that's really bad for your health and your mental stability. But the other side is, do people who are happy stay healthy? And there we found something quite interesting as well, which was that it wasn't so much cheering yourself up that would make you stay healthy. So if you hear advice, you know, sit home and watch a lot of comedies, and, you know, that'll make your health get better because, you know, everybody knows that laughter is good for your health. Well, we didn't really find that. We found actually the people who live more meaningful lives, involved with other people, those people, they became happy and healthy. So it wasn't the happiness per se that was causing the good health. Happy people were healthier. Healthy people were happier. But it was because of the way they lived their lives that made them both happier and healthier. So we say, don't just go try to cheer yourself up with kind of superficial things. You want to make yourself happier and healthier, you know, get involved with something meaningful in your life. It doesn't have to be anything that I recommend or that, you know, somebody's telling you to do. Something that you feel is meaningful that maybe helps other people. And that brings, that kind of positive energy both brings you happiness and it brings you good health.
If you don't like your career, will that cut your life short?
Well, it wasn't so much, no, how much you liked it. We looked at that in some detail. Were you in your ideal career, just what you wanted to be? And it turned out, didn't much matter for your long-term health. I mean, if you hated your job, that wasn't good. But, you know, if you had thought you want to do one thing and you wound up doing something else, as long as you could progress in it, make a contribution, move up in the world, then you thrived quite well. So it wasn't, you know, a lot of young people, they worry, you know, what if I don't find the right career for me, or which career is going to be perfect one for me, and otherwise I'm going to be unhealthy and unhappy my whole life. We didn't find that at all. We found that people were very adaptable, and once they found something that they liked and can get involved in, then they thrived, and they rarely had regrets.
Single people versus married people.
Well, that gets a little complicated. It was really very intriguing. The Longevity Project looked into that in quite a bit of detail, and differed between men and women. So you always hear this advice, get married and you'll live longer. Well, we didn't find that at all. And, you know, one of the reasons is because 100% of divorces begin with marriage. So we found that divorce was a threat to most people, especially the men.
It's devastating to them, isn't it?
Right.
In some cases.
Yeah. The men who got divorced and stayed divorced, or got divorced, remarried, got divorced again, their risk of dying young skyrocketed, and very few of them actually lived even to age 70. So if you were a man who was suited for marriage and you could stay in a stable marriage, that was really healthy. But otherwise, not so good for men to get married. For women, it was very different. So women who got steadily married and liked their marriages, that was good for their health. But single women did fine. And really, in contrast to the men, we found that the women who got out of bad marriages, got rid of their husbands, they lived almost as long as the women who were in good marriages and stayed married. So for women, it wasn't the man that married the man that mattered much for them. Women who got divorced, they did quite well. Single women also did quite well, and often single men did, especially if they had friends. And that was really one of the differences between men and women in marriage, that women had their friends they could talk to. They had female friends, and when they didn't have their men, that wasn't a big problem. But men tended to rely on their wives for their social networks, for their ties, for their social life. And when they lost their women, then they were really all alone and isolated. So there's some good lessons there to be learned.
Well, I think so. And, you know, and maybe, too, because of the man, whether he's going through a divorce or not, seems to have more pressure on him to, you know, to deliver. You know, it's, you know, even though it's a society now of both men and women working in the household, the guy is still relied on to bring in most of the bread and butter. And maybe he can't take that.
Well, I think that's true. Sometimes it's the pressures of the workplace. But again, the people who were involved in successful careers, that was protective for them, even if they were demanding careers. We found again and again in the Longevity Project that people who could relate well to other people and help other people, whether sometimes it was religion that helped them, sometimes it was social clubs, sometimes it was volunteering. A lot of times it was volunteering. In fact, I just read an obituary of one of the Terman participants who just died recently. And when after he retired, he spent decades reading recordings for the blind, and he actually read the most recordings that anyone has ever done in his 90s. So if you can do things and you're involved with other people and making a difference in the world, it's kind of a good news story that helps your own health as well.
All right, give us some tips on what we can do to either change our lifestyle or temper it a little bit in order to live a little longer, based on your study.
Well, of course, I have to tell you, get the book and look at the examples in there. There are quizzes in there. You can plot your own trajectories and see what kind of pathway you're on. And then you have to individualize it for you. So there are some things that are true in general, but some things are particular for the person. So when Mark Twain turned 70, he said, "I've never taken any exercise except sleeping and resting, and I never intend to take any. Exercise is loathsome." So, he said, what's good for me is not good for you, and what's good for you is not necessarily good for me. So that's the first thing, is to kind of understand what you've been doing and where you're going. If you can gradually increase your activity levels, that's good. If you've, you know, already are really active and you've been falling off, then, you know, you see something you need to do there as well. Probably the single most important thing, though, people could do is examine who they're interacting with, who they're associating with, and the quality of those relationships. So that's something that any of us could do. We could say, you know, this friend is trouble. I'm gonna get away from that person. This group I don't really like. These other people, on the other hand, they're healthy. They make me feel good, and that's the group I'm gonna spend more time with. So, if I had to, you know, give you one particular bit of advice that generalizes across people, that would probably be it.
You've got a assessment quiz on your website, Howard, of course, and let's go through some of the points, and you can just quickly explain them to us. Are you conscientious in a health-relevant sense? Explain that.
Well, the biggest predictor of longevity and health longevity in childhood and in adulthood was being prudent, being planful, and being persistent. And persistent is the one that I like the best, because it turns out there's a lot of forks in the road in your life, and the ones who can kind of stick with it, stick with their goals, that had health benefits. You know, it helped them with their relationships and it helped them with their careers, but it also helped them with their health. So, you know, if you tend to be a person who can't persist on things, that's something you need to think about and, you know, maybe do something about.
Next up, do you have a sociable personality? Are you a good emotional communicator?
Well, the emotional communication is really essential for a lot of people. You don't have to be sociable in the life of the party. We found that extroverts were not necessarily the longest living, but you have to be able to relate on some level with other people. So, like you said, there is a scale there that gives you some sense of your emotional sociability and how you relate to others. And there are things you can do to improve that. Some of it is just trying to express your emotions a little bit more. And there's increasing evidence that people who open up a little bit often do quite well in terms of their relations with other people and then in terms of their health.
Next up, are you a moody worrier?
Well, yeah, we didn't talk too much about that yet, but that's really interesting, too. We found, contrary to what we were expecting and what everybody always says, that worrying was often quite good for your health. So especially if you were kind of persistent and conscientious, and you would worry about things, that turned out to be health protective. We looked, for example, at men who lost their wives. They were widowers. And if you faced a stress like that and you didn't worry, you were doomed. It was the men who said, you know, wait a minute, you know, I'm alone now. I'm under this difficult situation. I need to take better care of myself. Those people stayed healthier and thrived. So we're not saying everybody should live their life going through worrying about everything, but we also think it's bad advice that everybody's always hearing. Don't worry, be happy. Don't sweat
That's
anything.
Right.
It's really, you know, don't sweat the small stuff, but the big stuff, it's really important to sweat.
We talked about the gloomy chicken little, but let's rehash that again.
Okay, well, people who catastrophize, who think when one thing happens that every bad thing is going to happen, that's really bad for your health, especially makes you more prone to depression and more prone to get into violent accidents, to be involved in homicide or suicide. So if you're like that or you know somebody who's like that, every time one little thing happens, they think the world is coming to an end, everything's terrible, those are thought processes that can be changed. So the good news there is it's just how you think about things, and people can learn to think about things in a more positive way.
Now, what do you mean by did your early education predispose you to long life?
Well, one of the findings that we looked at is what year the determined participants in the Longevity Project started school. So they were bright kids, and some of the parents, like some parents today, they say, you know, I'm going to give my kid a real head start and start them earlier so they'll be able to get ahead in life and, you know, accomplish much more. So we looked if they started school at age 6 or before, you know, first grade formal schooling at age 6, like most students they were. Well, they, you know, the parents pushed them in a little earlier, age 4 or even age 5, and it turned out to be a predictor of problems. If you started school in formal classroom setting before age 6, like first grade and at age 5, you were much more likely to die throughout the rest of your life as you became an adult. It set in motion a whole bunch of things. You know, you didn't relate well to your classmates, but also we know now that young children need time for themselves to play, to do unstructured activities. So that's the nice thing about the Longevity Project. We can look at things that they were doing early in life and, you know, like what age they started school. And if you did start school and you've always felt out of place in your school, that's a risk factor, and you need to, I think through what your habits are these days and what your social relationships are like.
And are you satisfied with your life in a way that impacts your health? Explain that.
Well, that refers to the cases of people who faced early life challenges and stresses. So if your parents got divorced or if other things happened, interestingly, if one of your parents died when you were young, it wasn't as much of a threat for your health. Of course, it was sad, and nobody appreciated that, but it didn't affect their health like divorce did. But if you got to a point in your life, even in your 20s, where you thought you were on the right path, you were satisfied with what you were accomplishing, you could have relationships with people, then you're probably going to stay healthy. And so that assessment in the Longevity Project book lets you evaluate where you are on that dimension.
We've talked about, of course, masculine or feminine and your health based on your job and things like that. But you also mentioned here religion. Why is that important?
Well, there's a lot of studies that show that religious people tend to live longer, especially religious women tend to live longer. And we were curious about that. So we wanted to see, first of all, if that was true in the term and participants in the Longevity Project. And we did find that the women who were more religious, and how many religious books they read and how much they went to church and how much they said they were religious. But then we wanted to figure out why. Was it the prayer? Some people think prayer is the key to health. And we found that it wasn't the organized religious observance per se that was so important. The reason the religious women lived longer, well, two kinds of things. One is, first of all, they tended to be healthier habits. So, the people who were more religious tended to, be less likely to smoke and to drink and all the obvious kinds of things. But the really interesting thing was that the people who were involved in organized religions often had good social ties. So they saw a lot of people each day. They were involved in helping other people. A lot of religions encourage you to volunteer. And that turned out to be the key to their long life. So it was also true that other people who were not religious or involved with religions, but did the same kinds of things, were helpful to other people and involved with other people, they also lived long. So it wasn't the prayer per se, but religion for a lot of people did help them stay healthier.
Okay, so was there anything that surprised you that went contrary to what your own belief systems might have been before you got all the results in?
Well, almost everything was surprising. We didn't really expect most of this to come out the way it did. I think one of the things that got me thinking personally was because we found that people who stayed active and stayed involved lived long, that a lot of advice about retirement is bad advice. So you hear, a lot of people want to think, I just got to get away from my job. I'm going to go sit on a beach in Hawaii, and then everything will be perfect in the world. Well, I think a lot more now about, retirement and is that such a good thing? And I think it's not. For a lot of baby boomers who are rushing to retirement, they should think twice. If it's going to take you away from your friends and away from the kind of work you like, probably not a great thing for your health to rush off and retire. On the other hand, if you get involved in some activities where you're helpful to other people and you're going to spend your time doing something like that you really don't have enough time for right now, then that probably is going to be good for your health. So there are a lot of issues about retirement that really was surprising and really make me and my friends think a lot about that.
Okay, absolutely. Well, you've done a great job with it. Now, what do you do with it? You've put it into the book form, of course, but do you present it to any special journals, medical journals, anything like that?
Oh, yeah, there are already over 50 scientific publications that we've done that come out of this project.
Right.
And there are hundreds of talks and posters and presentations at scientific conferences. And the point of the book was to bring it to a broader audience, your listeners and other people around the world. So maybe some of the health policy people will start thinking more broadly about some of these really important issues that affect the public health.
All right. Well, you stay with us. We've got a final hour to go with you, Howard, and we're going to take phone calls, maybe even stories, people with their own personalities and what they think has affected their own lifestyle. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.